Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. Let me just say a little bit about that promo video that you just watched. This coming Saturday, we are holding a free conference in Toronto, and it's free admission. We even have a free lunch provided for those who will be attending. And it will be held at the Oakwood Wesleyan Church at 33 Brandon Avenue. It's by Dufferin and DuPont, if you know the area of Toronto. And it runs from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's a very important conference. We've invited various churches in Toronto and the GTA and abroad to come and join us. So if you're interested, please meet with me after the service and I can give you more information. This is a vital, vital topic. Well, first of all, let me just say that I am very happy to be back at Newcastle Baptist Church. The last time I was here, I was still preaching in your gymnasium. And I see that you have this beautiful auditorium, and I think it's just lovely. It's a beautiful auditorium, and so it's a great pleasure to be back here. When Pastor Jacques reached out to me and asked if I can come and preach, I looked at my schedule, and I had this Sunday open, and I thought, absolutely, I would love to come and meet up with you again face to face. So our brother Fred already read from the passage in Isaiah 5, verses 20 to 25. And I wanted to address the question about truth in our day and this dividing line. Let me just give you a bit of background to this text of the prophet Isaiah. The prophet Isaiah was an 8th century BC prophet. He lived in the 700s BC. And he was, from what we can tell from the book that bears his name, he was a priest, because in chapter 6, as he was serving in the temple, he had this majestic vision of the Lord sitting on his throne and commissioning him for the work he was to do as a prophet. The prophet Isaiah was sent to a people, his own people, the people of Israel, who were in a state of apostasy. They were in a state of turning away from God. In the first chapter of Isaiah, God brings indictments against Israel for forgetting him, for forgetting his law. He condemns them for being a people who were obsessed with religiosity. They crossed their T's, they dotted their I's, they went to the temple, they gave the necessary sacrifices they were to give according to the law of Moses. But God said, "But your hearts are far from me. You honor me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me, because you follow instead the traditions and commandments of men." And as we look through the Old Testament, remember we're told the Old Testament was written so that we would learn. It provided examples that we as the church today should learn not to repeat the mistakes of the past. And the problem with human beings, ladies and gentlemen, is that human beings have an uncanny ability to keep repeating the mistakes of the past. And as the philosopher George Santayana once said, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And so when we look at this book of the prophet Isaiah, we could look at it, this 8th century text BC, and we could look at it and say, my heavens, this almost looks like an exact replica of what we're experiencing in the 21st century. Isaiah is sent to an apostate people, a people who claim to be religious on the outside. Yes, they went to church, so to speak. They went to church. They punched in and punched out. They kept all the ceremonies that were necessary. But God looked at them and said, "You don't know me. You don't honor me. Your hearts are far from me. You praise me with your lips, with your mouths, but your hearts are foreign from me." Is this not a picture of even many of our churches today? How many of us go to church on Sunday morning because it's just a thing to do? We go to church on Sunday morning and we sing those songs, but how many of us actually do what those songs say? A.W. Tozer once said, "Christians are known to lie well, especially when they sing." And so we sing songs like, "All to Jesus we surrender." But then when we meet life's challenges, we don't surrender to him. We claim that we would never deny him. We look at Peter, who denied the Lord 3 times, and how many times have we denied him? We look at Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him for 30 pieces of silver for the price of a dead slave. 30 pieces of silver. How many times have we betrayed him? When we put our talk to our walk, how often are we consistent? Are we truly doing the things that Christ calls us to do in this world? God hates religiosity. If you think God is impressed with religion, God reveals through his word that he hates religiosity. Religion, according to James in the New Testament, religion is to take care of widows and to feed orphans. That is pleasing in the sight of God. But God hates religiosity. God hates the outward show of looking religious, but inside we are nothing but hypocrites. And this is what the prophet is sent to do, to call Israel back to God, to remind them that it's not the rituals that God wants, it's not the religiosity that God wants. God wants a broken and contrite spirit. God wants a broken heart, a true heart of contrition and repentance. And so just like Israel of old, we see church today, many in the church think that being a Christian simply means going to church, or you have what I call the three-wheel Christians. You wheel them in as children to dedicate them to the Lord, and then you wheel them in with a limousine to get them married, and then you wheel them in the hearse for the funeral. But that is not Christianity. Christianity is taking up your cross daily and following him. And those who carried the cross were those who were going to their deaths. They were going to the place of execution. They were on their way to Golgotha. And just like Israel of old, God speaks and says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil." Those who call what God has pronounced good, the world calls evil. And what God has pronounced evil in this world, the world calls good. They have put darkness in the place of light. They've put light in the place of darkness. They've put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. This is where we are at today, ladies and gentlemen. We live in a world where there is no belief in objective morality. We believe that the things that God has said were good, society says, is repressive. It is racist. It is discriminatory. God has determined and created marriage as a foundational ordinance of society. That marriage he defined as the union of a man and a woman made in his image to procreate life in his image. And what have we seen in our society? In Western society, which was built on Judeo-Christian principles, society has redefined marriage so that marriage is no longer the union of a man and a woman to the exclusion of others. Marriage is now the union of two persons, irregardless of their sex, so that men and men and women and women, and now they're talking about expanding it into polyamorous relationships where you can have multiple partners and be married to multiple partners. And this is opening the door now to polygamy. Muslims are lobbying Ottawa to permit polygamy, because in Islam, a Muslim man can have up to four wives. And so our society has taken this wonderful institution, the very foundation of society, and has relabeled it. The Christian understanding of this, they say, is repressive. It's discriminatory. And so, with marriage being thrown out the window, we see this assault on the family, the definition of family itself. You'll notice that today the family is no longer what we historically understood as the nuclear family of a husband and a wife and a child. The family now could be multiple partners with an adopted child. It could be a homosexual union with a child that has been adopted or taken through a surrogate woman who bore that child on their behalf. With the destruction of the family, we see the destruction of human identity. And so what do we see today? Man is redefining language. Man is redefining the family. And what do we see as a result of this? We now see an assault on our own identities. And so if I were to say to you, are you a male or a female? Some people are saying, I'm neither. I don't identify as male or female. I may have a man's body, but I identify as a woman. And now we have transgenderism. We now have universities like the University of Toronto and many others that are demanding that you respect the preferred pronouns of certain people who do not identify as binary, that is, male or female. And so today, you have now in the state of New York over 70 different pronouns. You have zer and z and zim and they. And about 2 years ago or so, at the University of Toronto, Dr. Jordan Peterson, a psychologist, pushed back against this and said, I will not allow you to compel speech. I will not allow you to tell me how to speak. Because Dr. Peterson is a specialist. His area of expertise is on the effects of the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century and what they have done to people and what they have done to society. And one of the things he noted that all these totalitarian regimes did, the regimes of Lenin and Stalin and Mao Zedong in China and Pol Pot in Cambodia, all of these regimes compelled speech. They came up with new pronouns, new terminology. And this is where George Orwell wrote that book, 1984, a frightening book, a book that is so prophetic, a book that if you read it, you feel like you're reading our 21st century newspapers. And what we find now is we find the government telling you that if you do not refer to someone by their preferred pronoun, you can be charged with a hate crime. And so in British Columbia, a father was charged because he refused to call his son, who identified as a woman, he refused to call her by her preferred pronouns. So now, ladies and gentlemen, the state now is controlling your children. The state now is telling you what you should do with your children and how you should raise them. That is a frightening prospect. And now we see why so many families are going the route of homeschooling, and I don't blame them. Many parents do not trust the public schools because the public schools have now become indoctrination centers. To tell your children that sex is not biological, sexual identity is a social construct. It is created. It's not real. And so in the universities, if you have to go to the bathroom, you'll notice a sign saying that this is a gender neutral or a gender free bathroom. So you can walk into the bathroom and there could be a lady in there who identifies as a man or vice versa. And people look at this and say, my heavens, how did we get to this point? How did we get to a point in our history where biological sex is now being called nothing but a social construct, that it's not real, and that gender identity is fluid and so forth? Well, there's a reason for that. We know why this is happening. I wish I had good news for you this morning, but I don't. The news today is very grim. As we see a government that runs this country that is against the idea of nationhood, we have a government that believes in globalism, no borders. We should have a borderless country. There shouldn't be any nations. We should be a one-world nation. And yet the people who say we shouldn't have borders, we shouldn't have walls, live in some of the most secure walled houses in the world. Just recently, the Pope said, we should not have any walls dividing countries. Donald Trump should not build that wall to prevent people from Mexico from coming in. And yet, if you just Google the papal residence in the Vatican, he's surrounded by very, very high walls. And so I tweeted the Pope about a week or so ago, and I said, Pope Francis, lead by example. I pulled a Ronald Reagan on him. I said, Pope Francis, tear down that wall. As he told Gorbachev, if you remember, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. That's my best Reagan impression. I should have started with, well, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. Well, Pope Francis, tear down that wall. How many of you left your homes today and locked your doors? Anybody? Why? Why'd you lock your doors? Are you afraid of something? You don't trust people enough that, okay, you think they're going to break into your home, steal your money, steal your TV, and steal all the, okay, I get it now. Anybody here, do you have property lines in your, do you have property lines, property, yeah, why don't we get rid of those? Why do we need property lines? Do you have picket fences? Do you have fences around your property? Let's tear those down. Why do we need picket fences? Why do we need fences around 24 Sussex in Ottawa? Mr. Prime Minister, lead by example. Tear down those walls. Take in migrants into your home. You see, folks, this is the world we're living in. What God says is good, and if you really want to understand who created the concept of nation, I'm a proud, people say, are you a nationalist? Yes, I'm a proud Canadian. I love my country. I want to see my country restored to her glory that she once had. Well, if you're a nationalist, then you must be a Nazi. Well, because Hitler was part of the nationalist party, the Nazi nationalist party. But there's a big difference between being part of a Nazi nationalist party that says we're going to conquer the world and the Aryan race is going to conquer the world and take over, and being a proud nationalist and saying I'm a Canadian and I'm proud to be a Canadian and our neighbors south of the border are Americans and they're proud Americans. Well, you see, what we find here is we find that the first attempt to create this one world government, this one world borderless government, there's an event in the Bible called the Tower of Babel, where people came together. They were one language, one tongue, they were one people, and they built this structure. They wanted to access the heavens and so forth. They wanted to reach the gods, and they called it Babel. And the word Babel is a Hebrew word, it's a Semitic word that means the gate to God. Bab means gate, and El is God in Hebrew. And so they were trying to, if you will, penetrate the heavens, make a tower. We know what they're called. They're called ziggurats. They're these spiral staircases that the Mesopotamian folks would make. You could still see them in the deserts of Iraq today. And so what happens in that story is God comes down and he confounds their language and he forces them out. They have to spread out because that was the divine command. Fill the earth. Go out. Populate the earth. They were congregating. They were disobeying the command to go out. They were congregating in one spot and they were making a name for themselves. And so God disperses them, and by dispersing them and changing their languages, this forces them to create nations. Then you get the Table of the Nations in Genesis 10. And then God calls this guy by the name of Abram from Mesopotamia, who later he renamed Abraham, and God calls him out and says, get out of the country of your fathers, out of the Ur of the Chaldees, go into this land I'm going to show you, and then listen to what the Lord said. He says, I will make of you a great nation. And I will make your name great. God is the creator of nation states. And what we find in our world today is an attempt to undermine that concept and bring the world back under that one mantle of that one language, one world government, and so forth. Depending on your eschatology, some commentators believe that this is exactly what Antichrist will do before the coming of Christ. He will create a one world government with a one world currency and bring the world back under that mantle again. So, woe to those who call evil good and call good evil. We call this cultural relativism. What cultural relativism basically says is, it may be wrong for you, but it's right for me. It may be right for you, but it's wrong for me. So, this whole idea of morality is relative. There's nothing really objective about morality. It's simply relative. And so, you'll hear people say things like, well, abortion may be murder to you, but it's not to me. It's a woman's right. A woman says, it's my body, it's my choice. And so, when I meet someone who supports abortion, and they say, well, it's a woman's body, and therefore she can destroy the fetus if she wants to. And in Canada, you may not know this, but in Canada, you can terminate a pregnancy up to the 9th month. This is a big deal in the United States. They're fighting about this. But in Canada, you can kill a child in the womb up to the moment of birth. Because according to Canadian law, the Criminal Code of Canada says that a child is a person only when the child exits the womb and breathes. Before that, that child is legally still not a person. And so, when women say, it's my body, and I ask her, so if you're pregnant, how many legs do you have? Well, I have 2. No, you don't. You have 4. How many fingers do you have? I have 10. No, you don't. You have 20. Why? Well, because that baby is your body, right? So now you've got 10 and 10. Now you've got 20 fingers. Oh, no, I don't have to. No. Oh, so you mean the child is a separate entity inside you? Oh, okay. And that's what science shows, that the child is a separate entity. And yet we live in a world where in the state of New York, it is illegal to kill or execute a criminal with a lethal injection, but it is totally permissible to inject a lethal injection into the womb of a woman to kill her baby. In California, they're saying it's now illegal to use straws. Because the environment, my heaven, the environment. But it's okay to have safe injection sites. Just like in Toronto, we have safe injection sites. So rather than try to fight this and stop it, we throw in the towel. In the University of Toronto, or various universities, when I speak, you see the dangers, this danger of cultural relativism. Students would actually come up to the microphone and say things like, "There is no such thing as truth." And I would ask them, "Is that statement true?" Well, if there's no such thing as truth, well, your very statement is not true. All you've done is jumped in the boat with one oar and done this. You've just gone in a full circle. You haven't proven anything. Or others would come up and say, "There are no absolutes." And I would ask them, "Are you absolutely sure about that?" And they would say, "Absolutely." Most students today are not listening. They're not even, they're not paying attention to what they're saying. And then I'll have others say things like, "You cannot know anything for certain." "Are you certain about that?" And they say they are. They don't get it. It's like saying, "Never say never." You just said never. "Don't judge, lest you be judged." Are you judging me when you say, "Don't judge, lest you be judged"? Of course you are. So this is the world that we live in today. Why do you think the book of Judges exists in the Bible? Remember in the book of Judges, we heard our brother earlier talk to the children about Gideon. You ever notice in the book of Judges, you have this great book and you see these guys like Gideon and Samson. They go, "Wow, these guys are awesome." And all of a sudden, they goof up. Gideon fumbles. Samson fumbles. He ends up blind in the end. He's mocked by the Philistines, and God allows him to die with his enemies. So we read the book of Judges and go, "My heavens, first you got these guys and everything's going well, and then all of a sudden, they just fumble the ball. They goof up." But there's this theme that runs throughout the book of Judges. You ever notice what that theme is? That theme is, this was a time when people did what was right in their own eyes. That's cultural relativism. Right is determined not by God, by a transcendent law. Right and wrong is determined by you. We determine what is right and wrong. And so I was in a Twitter war with this atheist who said to me, "There are no objective morals. There's no objective evil or good in the world." And I said, "Okay, wonderful. So, rape, objectively wrong or not?" He says, "Well, rape is wrong, but you don't believe it's objectively evil. You just say it's inconvenient because it causes chaos in society. So rape isn't really evil. It's just counterproductive. And so we don't do it because it just doesn't really help the herd." But it says nothing about whether it is objectively right or wrong. They can't say that because they don't have an objective standard, which we have in God. And so what we need to realize is that if God does not exist, then we have no objective meaning and purpose in the world. The atheists will grant that. In fact, they grant that premise, that if there's no God, there's no objective meaning, and there's no objective morality in the world. And so atheists, you will notice, can never live consistent lives. So if you live a consistent life that you don't believe God exists, you cannot live a happy life. Well, why? Because you know that there's no meaning to the world. There's no meaning to your life. You just invent meaning. And what that also says is because there is no God, there is nothing beyond the grave. And so this is all you've got. This is the only life you have. And so the incentive is, if this is the only life I have, why should I be a good person? Now think about that with me. The only reason why we're good is because we believe there's something in it to be good. There's some type of a reward that will be acknowledged. But if there is no God, then the stupidest thing you would want to do is be a nice person. And so back in the 70s, there was an airplane that flew out of Washington, D.C., and it actually went down into a frigid river during the winter, the Potomac, I believe it was, and the people survived. They were all out in the water, and a helicopter came by with a ladder, dropped the ladder, and they noticed a man in the frigid waters pushing people towards the ladder to save their lives. And as he would push them, they would start climbing up, and then he was the last man. And the helicopter had to go drop all these people and come back for him. By the time they came back, he had drowned because he suffered hypothermia. the media began to praise him as a hero. But in an atheistic world, he was the stupidest idiot in the world. Because what he should have done was push people away and gone to that ladder first. If you've ever watched Seinfeld, when George Costanza, well, he went to that party and somebody cried out fire, and he started pushing the old lady off the walker and the kids out of the way so he can run out the door to save his life. That's what you would rather do. What's the point of being selfless if there is no God? And yet, we live in a world where we pretend there's meaning. And yet, all the philosophers who have gone before us, people like Jean-Paul Sartre, who said that man is a meaningless being. Or Albert Camus said that man is nothing but a bubble on the ocean of nothingness. They understood the emptiness of existence if there is no God. Because if God does not exist, we have no purpose for our lives. We're just here by accident. We're just here. We're a fluke. That's all we are. And one day, we are going to die. And it's going to be over. Curtains are going to close. Hasta la vista, baby. And one day the universe is going to die in a heat death. Cosmologists, astronomers tell us the universe is heading towards a heat death. The sun will burn out, the stars will burn out, and all there will be is nothing but dark space with the carcasses of dead planets and satellites floating around. But that's how it will end if there is no God, if there is no meaning. And so we live in a world today where this is how we look at life. You'll notice in our world today that Christianity is the most persecuted religion in the world. Yet our federal government tells us that the greatest threat to Canada is white supremacy. It's not Islamic terrorism. And even though we just heard recently they've scrubbed out references, the Liberal government, I'm sorry, I don't really like getting political, but you just can't help it because it's part and parcel of our society. They've scrubbed out all references to Sunni and Shia Muslims in their reports on terrorism because they don't want to offend. We have words like Islamophobia and homophobia. What do these terms mean? They're terms that have been invented to shut you down. And so when I was talking to a lady at the University of Toronto who's a lesbian, she asked me what my thoughts were on homosexuality, and I said, listen, this, as a Christian, this is what I believe based on the Bible. And she turned to me and she said, oh, you're nothing but a homophobe. And I said to her, you're a heterophobe. She said, what's a heterophobe? I said, what's a homophobe? I said, a phobia is an irrational fear of something. Like if you have arachnophobia, you're freaked out by spiders. If you're hydrophobic, you're afraid of water, which isn't very good if you're a Baptist. And so what you need to understand is that a phobia is, psychologically speaking, an irrational fear. So when I talked to my homosexual friend, I said, I'm not afraid of you. I don't have an irrational fear of you. So why are you calling me a homophobe? And what is Islamophobia, by the way? An irrational fear of Islam. Well, how can Islam be offended? Islam is not a person. Human beings have rights. Ideologies don't have rights. Ideologies don't get hurt. People get hurt. And so why is it that we never hear in our society about words like Christophobia, where you hate Christians? We don't hear these words. Why? Because there is an undermining of our roots, of our Judeo-Christian roots. There are attempts to undermine the very roots of our society. Why? Because if you notice, there's this attack on colonization. We got to get rid of Johnny McDonald. And I'm not talking about Ronald McDonald from McDonald's. I'm talking about the first Prime Minister of Canada. And so in Kingston, Ontario, there was a bar there named after Johnny McDonald, and they got rid of it, well, because he was a colonizer and because he was disrespectful to the Chinese. Okay. Well, if you believe that, then you should stop taking the 401. Because it's the McDonald Cartier Freeway. It's named after our first Prime Minister. So I guess you're going to have to find an alternate route. You got to take the 407 or some other route. You can't take the 401 because it's named after Johnny McDonald. So what is going on? We're seeing the abolition of our history. And Karl Marx, the father of communism, said that the first principle of battle is to rewrite history. So we have revisionism, revising the past, revising history, making it look like the British Empire were a bunch of racist colonizers. But we never talk about the Islamic conquests. We never talk about how all of the Middle East was all Christian at one time. All of North Africa was all Christian. Israel was Christian. Syria was Christian. Iraq was Christian. Iran had become Christian. Today, it's all Islamic. How did the Muslims get from Saudi Arabia all the way to North Africa? By the sword of jihad. They took more slaves in the Eastern slave trade than the West did, and they castrated the males, the black males, and kept the females as concubines, and slavery still continues to this day in Islamic countries, and the West doesn't say boo. Why? Because the West says everything that is European, Western European, is oppressive. These other people here are the oppressed. And so you'll hear a lot of group identity today. That if you're a certain person, a certain color, a certain sexual orientation, you're more oppressed than Mr. Whitey. And it's okay to castigate whites, it's okay to be discriminatory towards white people, but you can't say the same about everybody else. Folks, we're in a war of ideas and ideologies. Notice what also the prophet says. Verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. There's a lot of arrogance today, isn't there? There's a lot of arrogance, and even in our government, the corruption that is searing through our government, not just ours, but every government. But the idea of arrogance, that man is the summit of all things, that man understands himself better than anyone else, that we are it. Totalitarian regimes, why do you think they're called totalitarian? Because they take over everything. Your language, your money, your house, your thoughts, they put a ceiling above you because there is nothing beyond that ceiling. There is no God up in the heavens. Everything is the government. The government rules everything in the place of God. That's what totalitarianism is. And if you look at the history of totalitarianism, you'll notice you have millions of bodies piled up on each other. You ever notice in our society we barely hear anything? Nary do we ever hear about communism. All we keep hearing about is the Nazis. The Nazis. Donald Trump is a Nazi. Right, that's why he's moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. A Nazi would do that. Trump is a Nazi. Anyone who disagrees with the liberal government is a Nazi. You're a Nazi. There's a Nazi. Everywhere a Nazi. You ever notice that? So that Nazi becomes that pejorative term for anybody that is perceived to be evil. You ever hear anybody say, you're a commie? And yet the communists killed exponentially millions more people than Hitler ever did in Germany. Well, why is it we're always hearing about the Nazis, but we never hear about the slaughter that Lenin and Stalin and Mao and Pol Pot brought? You know why? Because the professors, many of the professors in our academic institutions are closet Marxists. They agree with the ideology. And that's scary. Notice the prophet also says, verse 22, woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink. It's interesting that he mentions those who drink and those who try to cover that pain with alcoholism. We now live in a country where it's now legal to smoke marijuana. It's now legal to purchase it. I can't go in certain places at the University of Toronto. I can't go certain places without smelling this thing in the air. It's always there. We're living in a time where what is considered harmful, and I'm not talking about medicinal uses here. Don't get me wrong here. I'm talking about the use of this particular weed, as they call it, that does have horrible effects on some people that go unreported. Some people have become suicidal and have committed suicide because of what it does to their brains. But isn't it interesting, verse 23, the prophet raises this point, who acquits the guilty for a bribe and deprives the innocent of his right? What do we find? When we reject God, when we deny God, what we find is corruption, even in the highest courts of the land. There's corruption in our judicial system. where people are given certain breaks because they break the law, but the common man gets charged when he or she commits the same crime. That's why people today don't trust the justice system. Many people today even have questions about police enforcement, where officers, the OPP, there was a report just out in the National Post last week that the RCMP has had a spike in suicides. Officers working hard, putting criminals behind bars, only to see those criminals being let out again because of a slight infraction in the process or because the judge didn't deem them to be a threat. When we forget God, our morals go out the window, justice goes out the window, and corruption comes in. I just want us to look at verses 24 to 25 as we draw to a close. What is the result of all this? Therefore, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble and dry grass sinks down into the flame, so their root will be rottenness. Their blossom will go up like dust. And here's the reason, folks, where we are today. Here's the reason why the West is crumbling. Here's the reason why Western Europe, from whence we draw our roots as a nation, Western Europe is crumbling morally. The churches in Europe, look at Notre Dame, that beautiful structure from the 14th century. You go to Europe today, some of the greatest churches there today, go there on a Sunday morning. They look like some of the churches in this area, in my area in Toronto. They're all empty. They've become museums. And as illegal immigration starts coming into the country, and as these groups are beginning to have more and more children, and many in the Muslim world have already said, as Muammar Gaddafi actually said before he died, we will destroy Western society in Europe not by the sword, but by the womb. We will outnumber the Europeans and establish the Islamic Caliphate in Europe. The reason why we are where we are is found in these verses, the second clause of verse 24, for they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts. They've despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. We have turned our backs on God. We've taken Him out of our schools. So today, you will not hear the Lord's Prayer uttered in the schools. How many of you were raised in schools and you would say the Lord's Prayer every morning? And you would sing, God Save the Queen? Well, the Ontario Court of Appeal ruled that that is unconstitutional, that you cannot have prayers. Prayers are religious. We've got to keep them separate. But every Friday across Toronto, every Friday in public schools funded by Toronto taxpayers, they're converting their cafeterias into mosques where Muslims are praying in our schools during school hours. And then when we object to that, they say, well, we have to accommodate according to Human Rights Act of Canada. Christianity is under the gun. Persecution is coming. It's coming, folks. What are you going to do? Are you ready? And are you sure if you're ready for it? God is going to weed out of His church all the tares. All the weeds are going to be weeded out, no pun intended. And He's going to remove all the goats from the flock. The time of testing will come. And those who are faithful unto Him, they will endure. Those who endure unto the end, they will be saved. But a great time of testing is coming. And then you will see those who are loyal to Christ and those who are not. And despite all this, what does the prophet say, verse 25? The anger of the Lord is still kindled. Notice it's kindled against His people. Why is it kindled against His people? Because His people are the salt of the earth, the light of the world, and yet we have lost our saltiness and we have hidden our light. And when salt loses its saltiness, it's good for nothing but to be thrown out. And if you don't shine your light, He's going to take you out. I didn't even know I was a poet. If you don't shine your light, He's going to take you out. Judgment, Peter says, must begin in the house of God. God's anger is still kindled against His people. His hand is still stretched out. And it says that He has struck them down. The mountains have quaked. Their corpses are like refuse in the midst of the streets. How many more bodies do we have to see strewn across the streets in bombed churches as we saw in Sri Lanka? God's anger is going to be unleashed on a world that has killed more children through abortion than all the world wars put together. Their blood cries out to God for vengeance, and He will speedily avenge them. And so, church, this is the time to stand up. I don't know how long I'm going to be able to do this. I remember appearing on a TV show, and we were talking about ISIS, and we were talking about Islamophobia and so forth. And the dean of the institution of the school that I was teaching at, and I'll just say it was a secular school, sent me an email and said, "We saw your video on television. Do not ever mention Islam or homosexuality if you want to keep working at this institution." And I think the time is coming when they're going to start imprisoning pastors who will not stop preaching against the abomination of same-sex unions. They're going to take away your tax exemption status. Churches are going to lose that. And so the days ahead are perilous. The days ahead, I'm not here to say the sky is falling. I don't believe in that. But what I am saying is, we got to be ready. The time has come. The time has come. Let us do what the Master commanded us to do, to be faithful, to occupy until He comes. Whoever is ashamed of me, He said, in this dark and adulterous generation, I will be ashamed of him when I come in the glory of my Father and His holy angels. He was not ashamed of you. Why would you be ashamed of him? So I'll call the worship team up as we conclude.